I'm going to turn the program over to Robin Proud.
Welcome, everybody. It's great to see you all. The Free Congregation of Sauk County is a Unitarian Universalist Fellowship and a welcoming congregation. This means that our invitation is to all, and that all are welcome here, regardless of race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, gender expression, or political persuasion. For our talk today, it's a bit esoteric, but I hope to expand it into a more general question that we can talk about later about the influence of popular culture on society. I've talked to you regularly about activist women, especially with the recent anniversary of women's suffrage. But you might remember I've also given a few talks about literature. I talked about science fiction. I've talked about humanist fiction. I talked about some women who were also authors, like Louisa May Alcott or Julia Ward Howe at our own local Zona Gale. But today I'm going to combine these two themes to talk about activism in women's fiction from around 1870 to 1920. Now, the material that I'll present today comes from this book, Romancing the Vote: Feminist Activism in American Fiction, 1870 to 1920, by scholar Leslie Petty. I found this the same way I found many of my ideas, which is browsing, when one could do that in the old days, browsing through used bookstores like the Frugal Muse here in Madison. Well, one of the talks that I gave in the past had to do with the effect of fiction on our personality. Some studies have shown that reading fiction increases empathy. Certainly, reading about people from different backgrounds widens our horizons and increases our interest in different subjects. A young person who reads about scientists of their own gender or race is more likely to feel comfortable aspiring to that position. It's been suggested that Americans were more willing to accept the Obama family in the White House after following the fictional Huxtable family on the old Cosby show. Of course, that's now questionable for different reasons, but still an interesting question. So I'm going to look at how activist women were presented, mostly to an audience of women, in the 50 years before the 19th Amendment was passed. But first, let's go back a little farther. In the colonial and revolutionary periods, women in America actually enjoyed a bit more freedom than before or after. Partly it was because of the ideals of the revolution, but also just practical necessity. Many men were away working or fighting. So Ben Franklin's sister, for instance, ran the post office. Abigail Adams ran the family farm. But as the nation became civilized and the Victorian era progressed, the feminine ideal in America as in England devolved into this vision of the woman as angel of the home in the domestic sphere. She should stay home and grace the house, raise the children, while the man went out into the rough world of politics and business. Of course, this was only for middle class and upper class white women. Lower class women, black women, native women, and immigrant women always worked. So this author, Leslie Petty, says, gives an example of what things were like during this Victorian period. In 1839, Sarah Josepha Hale, who I believe wrote Mary Had a Little Lamb, but she also published a novel called The Lecturess. It's about a woman's rights activist. She is very transgressive. She gives public lectures on gender reform and even ventures to the South to speak about abolition. This behavior in the novel leads directly to the loss of her husband and child and eventually to her death. So Hale is warning her readers about the dangers of women taking a public role in politics. This was on people's mind because there were women speaking out, the Grimke sisters famously speaking about abolition of slavery. Many people were afraid this would lead directly to the dissolution of American society. But although this heroine did not do well in the novel, Hale did originate a character, the feminist activist heroine, that became increasingly common in the national literary scene as the 19th century progressed to the 20th. Novels about politically active females written by men and women, both for and against feminist reform, were published in almost every decade of the 19th century and early years of the 20th. Now, excuse me, at this time, heroines of fiction generally had two possible endings for their stories, death or marriage. Remaining single wasn't generally an option, or being married and pursuing other interests. So we'll see how this played out. The feminists themselves knew that fiction could be a good tool. Within 5 years after the Seneca Falls Convention of 1848, a women's rights journal called UNA published its first issue. There was an essay entitled "The Truth of Fiction and Its Charms." It stated that fiction could depict possible arrangements of society that didn't yet exist. So fiction could get people to think about different ways that society could be organized. It could also, reading about socially active women could encourage readers to try it themselves. In the 1870s, Elizabeth Cady Stanton included in her feminist journal, The Revolution, a serial written by Alice Carey entitled The Born Thrall, or Woman's Life and Experience. She claimed this would have the same effect on women and their movement as Uncle Tom's Cabin had on abolition. Unfortunately, the author died before the story was complete. But 20 years later, Stanton reiterated her belief in the transformative power of fiction. She wrote a preface to a novel called Pray You, Sir, Whose Daughter. This suffrage novel was written in 1892 by Helen Hamilton Gardner, who was the subject of my last talk. So the leaders of the suffrage movement understood that fiction could help their case. The audience for these books was, of course, those who could read and who had leisure time to devote to a cause. Not only were racial concerns absent from most of these stories, but immigrants and former slaves were often used either as villains or comic characters. They were seen sometimes as obstacles to the advancement of society as opposed to women. You'll remember that most of the women's suffrage leaders chose to ally themselves after the Civil War with Southern whites by claiming that women's votes were needed to offset those of undesirables. Elizabeth Cady Stanton said in 1869, "Think of Patrick, that is the Irish immigrant, and Sambo, and Hans, all you Germans, and Ung Tung, who do not know the difference between a monarchy and a republic, who cannot read the Declaration of Independence, or Webster's spelling book. Think of them making laws for Lydia Maria Child, Lucretia Mott, or Fanny Kemble." Now, in their defense, Stanton, Anthony, and others had been assured that when suffrage was extended after the Civil War, it would include women. They naturally felt they had been betrayed. Many women in the suffrage movement had started as abolitionists. That was what got them interested in a social good. The women's movement had some different challenges and opportunities. It was the first time women could participate in a movement founded by and directed by women. They would need to convince the existing voters, men, as well as reluctant voters, other women who bought into the current views of true womanhood and the angel of the home. Two of the most popular novels in the 1850s were The Wide, Wide World by Susan Warner and The Lamplighter by Maria Cummins. In each case, an orphaned heroine learns the virtues of Christian submission and conformity, and is rewarded with a husband and a home. An early author to subvert this conformist tradition was Elizabeth Boynton Harbert. She wrote a book called Out of Her Sphere in 1871. Her heroine, Marjorie, reflects much of Harbert's own life. Here's something from Harbert's own wedding announcement in 1860. It described her as the well-known and talented lecturess who nevertheless found time to make her beautiful wedding dress of white satin and tulle, as well as much of the delicious wedding cake. Harbert insisted that equality in law was not inconsistent with the traditional Christian values of devotion to family and home. Harbert was not only a professional speaker, but she had been something of a rabble-rouser in her youth. She was denied admittance to Wabash College in Evanston, Illinois, because of her gender. So she organized a performance with 24 young women. It was a comedy satirizing this rejection. They raised enough money to fund a local library, a church organ, a town flag, and Evanston's first fire truck. She wrote in an afterword to her novel that literature was somewhat to blame for women's views of themselves as weak, because it often portrayed women as helpless, silly, and ignorant. Like Elizabeth Cady Stanton before her, Harbert set out to do for women in her novel what Harriet Beecher Stowe had done in Uncle Tom's Cabin, to make a segment of society real to the public through fiction. So her heroine, Marjorie, is disappointed in not being able to get an education, just as the author was. But she then feels God is calling her to be a preacher. Now, this was not at all accepted in many churches of the time, and even some today. And you probably know about Olympia Brown, a Universalist preacher who has a church named after her in Milwaukee. So for this character, Marjorie, she wants to be a preacher, and this way she can also help her brother, who wants to be a painter but has no means of support. She chooses not to marry. Instead of bearing a child, she adopts an orphan. She's described as lovely, feminine, and well-dressed. This is presumably to reassure the readers that all feminists are not ugly shrews. Marjorie has a male friend from childhood who eventually proposes marriage, but he wants her to give up her work, which she refuses to do, so he leaves. Later, however, he's converted by reading her writings, and he comes to appreciate her views and the possibility of an egalitarian marriage. So she gets the best of both worlds by being married and continuing her mission. As we've seen, the visible face of suffrage was a white woman. The first history was written by Susan B. Anthony, but in fact, Black women had organized for their rights years before Seneca Falls. Gloria Steinem mentioned this in an interview just recently. And Black women continued to be intimately involved in the struggle, even knowing they would be the last to benefit from it. Of course, the widely published authors were all white, but there was one striking exception, Frances Ellen Watkins Harper, and our opening and closing words today come from her. Harper was born into a free and prominent Black family in Baltimore in 1825, so well before the Civil War. By 1850, she had published poetry, so she was 25 then. She was speaking for abolition and helping people escaping by the Underground Railroad. So Wikipedia says, Harper founded, supported, and held high office in several national progressive organizations. In 1883, she became superintendent of the colored section of the Philadelphia and Pennsylvania Women's Christian Temperance Union. In 1894, she helped found the National Association of Colored Women and served as its vice president. She died at age 85 in 1911, 9 years before women gained the right to vote. She wrote her novel, Iola Lee, in 1892. She was 67 years old. Because she was well known for her poetry and lectures already, this novel received quite a bit of attention. Now, the heroine is described early on as being extremely light-skinned with blue eyes, so there's no question that she has African heritage, but she doesn't look Black. There is dissension on whether the author wanted to make her light-skinned as an example of colorism, that she herself thought this was more beautiful. Or maybe this was an appeal to white readers, that white readers would not want to read about a dark woman. Iola begins life unaware of the worst effects of race and gender oppression. As a young girl at a northern boarding school, she tells her classmates, "Slavery can't be wrong, for my father is a slaveholder, and my mother is as good to our servants as she can be." She receives a rude awakening when a plot twist allows a relative to remand Iola, her siblings, and her mother into slavery. She later concludes, "I used to say that slavery was right. I didn't know what I was talking about." Iola has been forced to become Black. But as the novel goes on, she also chooses to be part of the Black community. While she's working as a nurse during the Civil War, a white doctor offers to marry her in spite of her heritage, inviting her to move north with him and pass as white. She declines, choosing to stay with her people after the war as a teacher. Eventually, she meets and marries a Black doctor. She has learned about women's issues as well as racist issues. But her new husband tells her that she doesn't have to work. She says she wants to. She says every woman ought to know how to earn her own living. But she resents the betrayal of Black women by the overall women's movement. And she has a metaphor about this. It was as if two women were sinking in the quicksand. And on the solid land stood other women with lifelines in their hands. Seeing the deadly sand slowly creeping up around the hapless victims. To one, that is to the white woman, they readily threw the lines of deliverance. But for the other, there was not one strand of salvation. Another book that was written at the same time was by a man, Hamlin Garland, a well-known author, wrote A Spoil of Office in 1892. Its main character is a man who gets involved in politics, but at each step of the way, it's the activist female character who drives his increasing participation. The book opens at a Grange picnic. Bradley Talcott, a hired man, has no interest in politics. Then he hears the speech by Ida Wilbur, talking about the importance of community. He has a sort of epiphany watching her. On Bradley, standing there alone, there fell something mysterious like a light, something whiter and more penetrating than sunlight. As he listened, something stirred within him, a vast longing, a hopeless ambition, nameless as it was strange. He also has a strong attraction to Ida as a person. Now, as a result of this new view, Bradley begins to study, eventually entering law and politics. He begins to speak in favor of candidates, and he keeps following the speeches that Ida presents. Then he hears her speak about women's rights. She says, "It's not a question of suffrage merely. Suffrage is the smaller part of the woman question. It is a question of equal rights. It is a question of whether the law of liberty applies to humanity or to men only." Now remember, this was written in 1892. Right after suffrage was won in 1920, women began to work for the Equal Rights Amendment, and that is still an ongoing struggle, as you may know. In any case, Bradley is won over. He saw women in a new light, and he told her that she was right and that he'd never thought about it before. The trouble is, we men don't think about it at all. We need to have women tell us these things. This reminds me of a recent story from the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests by some athletes, that Black athletes shared with their teammates their personal experiences dealing with police or being followed in stores. And white athletes were often amazed, saying things like, "I had no idea." So back to our book here. Ida, the feminist speaker and activist, goes beyond traditional politics, and she actually works on forming a new party, and Bradley, our hero, is converted to it. This new party will explicitly support justice for everyone, Black, white, men, women, immigrants, farmers, factory workers. Now, earlier, Ida was a sort of muse or mentor to Bradley, but they do eventually get together, and she announces we'll work together. So the traditional marriage plot is fulfilled, but the married couple will each continue their work, even if they're sometimes apart. So again, this was 1892. When I was in college in 1970, a young man told me he didn't think women could have both a career and a family. Now, I readily admit that I didn't read any of the books I described so far, but I did read the next one. I found it in an online archive, and I read it on my computer. That wasn't as onerous as it sounds because it's just over 100 pages and the pages are small with big margins. You can get a sense of the book's tone by its humorous title, For Rent, One Pedestal. Now the pedestal in question could be the one on which women are placed by society to keep them out of the world, or it could be the soapbox on which suffragists stand. This book is told in the form of letters from the heroine, who has the charming name of Delight. She's writing the letters to her friend Barbara. Delight takes on working for a suffrage office because she needs a job at first. She's a college graduate and she's already been in the workforce. She's encouraged by her employer to speak in public about the social ills she saw in her previous job as a teacher. Soon she's a regular speaker and campaigner. There's a lot of humor describing the reactions of various crowds, the problems of unreliable automobiles. This book was published in 1917, and I was surprised that the characters make daily use of cars and telephones. They even mention moving pictures as something people regularly attend. In one scene, Delight goes to jail, charged with a traffic violation because she had organized a demonstration on the street. She's released in 3 hours and gains a huge following. She says, "It was more thrilling than any football game I ever saw." Another stunt is the biscuit making contest. She challenges any woman from the anti-suffrage campaign to make better biscuits than she does. The other side eventually declines to send anyone, but Delight bakes all day, sending the biscuits to charity, and of course getting a lot of attention. Now, in this book, the activist heroine is part of a supportive group, which really helps. She is part of an entire collection of suffragists working for the same cause. There is a man in the book who is at first skeptical of the movement, but comes around in the end in time to propose to our heroine. There is no expectation that she will stop her activism once she's married. The book is based on the real-life campaign for the vote in New York State in 1915, and as in real life, the campaign fails. But the activists feel they have taken great strides in arousing women. Now, as I mentioned before, these books were obviously aimed at white middle-class women. In the first section of For Rent, One Pedestal, Delight describes her day when she was a teacher. "For 10 days, I have patiently wiped the nose of Little Italy. I have extracted yards of raffia from the blouse of thieving young Poland. 100 times have I demanded that Rosalie keep in line. 40 times a day, I have showed Yetta, which is her right foot." So her view of these immigrant students is not exactly egalitarian. And in a later episode, Delight writes to her friend Barbara, "Everyone who has come into headquarters today has been chuckling over a joke I played yesterday." She went to the local library to request borrower's privileges and was told that she needed a male taxpayer to sign for her, which she was aware of this. First, she tried to use the name of another woman, Mrs. McKim, because she was the widow of the library's benefactor. Nope, turned down because she did not have a male property holder. She writes, "An hour later, I returned to the library, accompanied by my reference, Mrs. McKim's coachman, a Negro with only one leg and one arm, blind, illiterate, but a man, and a taxpayer by virtue of owning a little shack on the edge of the town. The attendant was inclined to temporize, but I said, 'Here is my man taxpayer ready to make his mark.' The newspapers this morning suggested a possible change to the rules of the library." So this is a bit problematic that in a way it showed how ridiculous it was that women needed a man to sign for them, and yet the black character is used for comic effect. And it goes with the strategy that some in the movement were using, that a white woman would be better than a black man who's assumed to be uneducated, somewhat comic, possibly repulsive. Now, I've chosen books that feature women actively working for suffrage. There were, of course, other books that were pointing out indirectly why women needed power. When I talked to you about Zona Gale, I mentioned her novel and Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Miss Lulu Bett, from 1920. The heroine is a spinster living with her sister and brother-in-law. Basically, she's an unpaid servant. At one point, she decides to leave and work in a hotel, where at least she would be paid for doing the same work, and she wouldn't be constantly watched and judged. Now, perhaps understandably, the 19th Amendment did not immediately lead to any large changes in political priorities. Most women who voted followed the parties of their husbands. And activism actually declined for a while. During the 1920s was the first Red Scare. Anyone working for reforms could be accused of being a Bolshevik. And the 1920s were also famously a decade when those with some money wanted to enjoy life now that the war was over. The one legislative outcome that may have been related to women's votes was the passage of Prohibition. So to conclude here, in an era before television and movies, popular novels and stories played a large role in how people thought of the world around them. These fictional characters and plots help us today understand the world and the aspirations of their time. But for our discussion today, I'd like to widen the subject to the influence of popular culture. Do TV shows featuring gay characters increase their acceptance in real life? What about depictions of Black men as criminals or Muslims as terrorists? How does that affect us? Would Donald Trump have been elected if voters didn't have in their minds a TV image, however false, of him as a savvy and decisive businessman? And how do the arts and popular culture reflect or shape the opinions of society? So we have time for comments. Yeah, and it makes you wonder what will be the what people will think in 100 years, provided we're still around 100 years. But for instance, that we kept animals in cages and ate them, you know, could be really, really shocking and disturbing to people in the future who could not believe how unacceptable that is. And therefore, many of us would be eliminated from statues or other memorabilia. So, yeah. On the other hand, with the statues, the point was that they were erected for a certain purpose at certain times, and were not not done out of pure motive either. And some comments have been made about, for instance, a woman president. It's like, well, you know, no one has seen one until they've seen one. That someone, a Black president, many people, including many in the Black community, thought that would never be possible. Or that it would not be possible that he would survive the campaign and his terms without being killed. That was a real concern. Yeah, and on the other hand, right, the fact that someone is a woman does not automatically, or is Black, or does not automatically mean that they're going to take certain positions. Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court does not have the same views that Thurgood Marshall had. Local connection. Who is it? Kamala Harris spent a year or two of her childhood in Madison because one of her parents was studying, I think, before her parents split up. But anyway, she has some memories of Madison. Get another connection.
Thank you very much, Robin. Thanks to all our attendees.
Thank you, everyone. Great to see you.
Thanks, everyone. Goodbye.